Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And as we record this, we're entering into March, which of course is Women's History Month. And I thought it might be interesting to talk about women's history in terms of something out of the ordinary, and that is women's relationship with alcohol and gin in particular. And I couldn't think of a better person to talk about it than my colleague who's been on the show before, Dr. Nicola Nice. And Dr. Nice is she is a brand strategist and consultant turned spirits distiller and owner of her own company, Pomp and Whimsy, in an effort to write women back into the cocktail history and into the history of distilling altogether. We'll find out from her, noticed a real lack in women in that industry. And she is an Oxford-educated sociologist and brand strategist, as I said, and made her career advising Fortune 500 companies on international branding and consumer rights. So she turned those insights towards her own business and developed this company, first coming out with a botanical gin liqueur, and she has some new announcements to make on that. It really took her into the world of gin. It is her goal to revolutionize the spirits industry for female consumers, and we will find out a lot more about that right now. Welcome, Nicola.
Nice to speak with you again, Linda.
So, what in particular, you said that you noticed, you dealt with a lot, let's put it this way, you dealt with a lot of people in the liquor industry. In fact, Forbes wrote about you and mentioned you in one of their articles, Women Running the Liquor World. Well, you must have been one of the few. So tell me a little bit about what spawned your interest in doing this and entering into the spirits world yourself.
Absolutely. So I've always had a fascination with people and behavior and the way that we interact with each other and objects and assign values to those objects. And that's what naturally led me into the world of branding and specifically consumer behavior and consumer insights. And I've always had an interest as well in the spirits space. I'm originally from the UK and I moved to the US in 2007, where I set up residence in New York City and very quickly discovered the incredible hospitality and cocktail scene of New York City. And over the next 13, 14 years, began to develop both a parallel professional and personal interest in the world of spirits from a professional point of view in the world of spirits branding, and obviously from a personal and academic point of view, the history of the cocktail and specifically women's role in it.
Right.
And I always felt as I was working with the big spirits producers that something was being left out of the conversation when it came to the female consumer. So as you reference, the industry has historically been a fairly male-dominated industry, although I'm very happy to say that that is changing, and it's changing quite quickly, actually. You mentioned that Forbes series on women running the liquor world, and I think they got up to 6-7, maybe more installments on that. So it was great to see that they kept uncovering more and more women who were making change there. But for me, going back to this question of why are women so ignored and misrepresented when it comes to the brand and marketing landscape, I felt that one of the big factors at that time was simply that there weren't enough women behind the scenes. And so that's why at some point, I felt like, okay, if I'm going to really be at the helm of changing this, I need to dive in feet first into actually producing and not just advising.
Yes. Well, of course, it's nice that you saw an open niche in the market too. That how good could that be? I mean, you know, that was perfect.
Right.
The perfect storm, as they say.
Yes.
Well, let's look back a little bit about, there's more than just that women were being ignored in the spirits producing end of it, mm-hmm. but there was a whole lot more going on. There's a whole, as you pointed out, a lot of propaganda generated against women and drinking, specifically drinking gin. So mm-hmm. can we back up and sort of talk a little bit about that? Because certainly people have maybe heard the reference to gin as mother's ruin or mm-hmm. have gone to a bar. I know we have one bar in my neighborhood called Mother's Ruin, and I know there mm-hmm. are several others. I'm sure across the country there mm-hmm. are others as well. Tell us what brought this all about.
Yes. So as you say, I mean, I grew up with that same same sort of colloquial slang for gin being called Mother's Ruin. And as I was developing what was a gin product, I wanted to really understand, okay, what's the history of women with gin, and why on earth do we call it Mother's Ruin? Yeah. And where did that come from, and how has that impacted our relationship with gin, and specifically women's relationship with gin, and then by extension, how we perceive women as drinkers of gin? So it was really sort of digging back into the history of gin. Mother's Ruin itself is a phrase that became a popular slang term for gin around the late 1800s, so the turn of the 20th century, is when we sort of start to see it really emerging in a lot of popular culture. But the phrase itself comes from a derivation from a much earlier phrase, from the gin craze of the early 1700s, back when the spirit was known as Mother Gin. So I think we can talk a little bit about that history of women and gin, and specifically date it back to the gin craze and see how it has evolved. And as you said, continue to impact the cultural narrative of women and gin through the propaganda been shared.
You mentioned Mother Gin, but even prior to that, it was referred to with mother in the title, and that's mother's milk when it was developed medicinally, correct?
Right. Yeah. So it's, I think it's interesting if we think about the semiotics of mother.
You're right.
Right. So I think, you know, back then that there's lots of different ways that you can think about the word mother and what that means. And I think what we're kind of seeing in its sort of common usage, during the late 1600s and early 1700s was this sense of dependency. When we talk about mother's apron strings, for example, it's this idea that we're somehow tied to the mother, and that the mother has ultimate sort of power over us, as it's, you know, the place where we're birthed. Everything originates with a mother. But then there's also this sort of sense of continuing to be attached to the mother. And of course, what we know about the gin craze was much like any other epidemic or drug epidemic that has happened over the centuries, is this sort of widespread dependency on something. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably has a lot to do with it. But I think it probably also has a lot to do with how gin started to become popularized at that time. So gin had obviously been around in England for at least a century before the gin craze took off. But it was really when William of Orange and Queen Mary II took the throne, and William obviously being from the Netherlands, that they really started to popularize gin at that time with high society. Mm. And of course, you know, there are many people who are better historians than I am who have written extensively on the different political happenings during the course of the late 1600s through to the mid-1700s around the gin craze. But essentially, William was responsible for deregulating gin, which then you know, made it very cheap to produce and is essentially what caused it to take off with great fervor and popularity. But even as that was happening, the fact that they were drinking it in the royal court, and then when he passed and Mary's sister, Queen Anne, came to the throne, she was a notorious lush, shall we say, and was a big fan. Her nickname was Dram Shop, apparently, but was a big fan of the spirit, as were her ministers. And so you see gin becoming socially popular, as well as very cheap to produce. And as you said, a slightly different perfect storm ensued. But that led to not just mother gin being the popular phrase for gin, but also Madame Geneva and Queen Gin. So this association of, I'm sure specifically Queen Anne and her love of gin, then started to cement its association with women.
Well, and, you know, a lot of people are under the impression that gin was invented and started in England because of its long history, as you just explained. But in fact, the king was from the Netherlands. And do you know anything about that, the truth and the fact that it really began by a Dutch pharmacist or physician or something?
Well, I read that juniper-infused distilled spirits were actually first created in Italy by Benedictine monks.
Well, you know, and that makes perfect sense, obviously. Yeah.
And people consumed it for its medicinal properties, and it's always had an association with being supposedly beneficial for gastrointestinal issues, which have always were very commonplace with the kinds of diets that people had at the time. But specifically, so the Dutch were obviously making Geneva, which was a malt-based juniper-laced spirit. And certainly that was already, as I said, in England, that already come into England. When that evolved into gin was essentially at this time when the production of gin was deregulated. And this came about essentially as a xenophobic act against the French. So, you know, England was fighting an ongoing war with the French, and the English people enjoyed drinking French brandy. And so in a double act of vengeance on the French, they raised import duties on French brandy and at the same time deregulated the production, the home production of grain-based gin spirits, white spirits in England,
or bathtub gin, as we came
right.
To
so
know
basically,
it, right?
they broke apart the Gin Distillers Guild, making it possible for anyone essentially to produce gin. And so once gin was started to be produced in the home, of course, that's when you can imagine women became very involved in that cottage industry.
Yeah. But, you know, you mentioned cottage industry and women brewing. And we talked about this when you were on last time, talking about women, writing women back into the cocktail history, because women were so important in actually bringing about the popularity of the cocktail and serving the cocktails. And even prior to that, way back when, we're talking about ancient times, I mean, women were the brewers. They were cooking in the home while having something to drink, and brewing was also part of the culinary act. So women were, in fact, you know, brewers way back then. So you know, it's not an unusual thing.
No, it was considered women's work.
Right.
You know, it was domestic work. And it wasn't until it was commercialized. And I think specifically, you know, obviously, you know, the success of gin acts of the early 1700s led to a lot of change. But one of those changes was, you know, bringing back the distillers guild, essentially. And so not allowing making it illegal to produce at home, and then obviously putting a lot of taxes on the retail of gin, and then, you know, very expensive licenses for the making and retailing of gin. And then, yes, essentially making it illegal to make gin at home. Mm. So once you've commercialized it, and then, of course, you have 100 or so years later, the evolution of the Industrial Revolution and then the Victorians taking hold of it. Now we have real separation of the public and private worlds. And I think probably at that point, that's when, even though, as we discussed on our last conversation, women were still producing beer, and they were producing liqueurs and brandies and cordials and so on in the home, you started to see the emergence of men really controlling this.
Mm. Well, there is a very public piece of propaganda, which is a piece of art that you feel is, you know, it's sort of perpetuated this image of women and alcohol, and was effective in what's been, as I said, perpetuated in their attitudes today. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, as we've been discussing, this sort of idea of Mother's Ruin being a synonym for gin, and that coming from Mother Gin and Mother's Milk, as you said, the British government, as they attempted to control what they saw was this, I mean, frankly, it was something that poor people and, of course, women and were consuming, and it was something that they felt was causing the destruction of society. So, as London was growing as a city, of course, as it became more and more urbanized, what you saw with that was the emergence of a lot more crime, a lot more vice, and this feeling that these crimes were always leading back to a story that started in a gin shop. And of course, wherever you find crime and you find vice, you find prostitution. And so this association of women and the degradation of society, which is the exact same narrative that was really driving a lot in the temperance movement as well, and this sort of desire to protect women from the harmful effects of these things, led to a lot of propaganda, specifically around women. And this really became concentrated around the time of the first major gin act, which was in 1736. And 2 years before that was enacted, there was a very famous case of a woman by the name of Judith Defoe, who was a poor woman, a single mother of a two-year-old daughter called Mary, who on an occasion in January 1734 apparently sold Mary's clothes and used the money to buy gin and left Mary abandoned in a ditch while she went out with her friend to go drink more. And because Mary was crying, they were concerned about someone finding her. And so they tied a handkerchief around her neck and to quieten her down, and essentially strangled her and murdered her. And Judith was tried in the Old Bailey for this crime, and she was convicted and she was hung. And this was really taken as, okay, this is the absolute depravity. You know, how much lower can you go
right.
than a mother abandoning her child, murdering her child, all in the pursuit of feeding her jinn habit? And so this narrative started to form a lot of the propaganda. I think prior to 1736, the concern was really just was more sort of widespread drunkenness. But post 1736 and before the other Big Gin Act of 1751, the narrative started to turn towards the issues of crime and specifically the issues with women. So after the 1736 Act, where it essentially became illegal to make gin at home, or put it another way, it became very expensive to get a license to make and retail gin. At the same time, there were incentives, rewards for people who informed on people who were producing gin. And of course, what happens as during any prohibition is it goes underground and people start selling it illegally anyway. And of course, right. gin consumption went up
right.
after that first Gin Act. But at the time, according to the historian Patrick Dillon, three out of four of the people who were brought before the magistrates for illegally selling gin were women. So what we don't know about this is whether that means women were selling gin more than men, or that people it was easier to inform on a woman who was.
Right.
right? We don't know that level of detail. But essentially, this helped to fuel this narrative of gin being a woman's issue, whereas in reality, during those years, there's no evidence to suggest that women were any more inebriated than men by gin or any more obsessed. And, you know, we can bring that argument to the present and talk about maybe in a minute about how people still continue to focus on the problems of women drinking
right.
versus men. But essentially, as the propaganda built up ahead of steam, this led to the second big act of the period. I mean, there were many acts in between, but of 1751, and the propaganda that was produced around that, including this engraving by the artist William Hogarth called Gin Lane. And this is a very, very famous picture. In fact, if you do a Google image search of Mother's Ruin or Mother Gin or the Gin Craze, this is the image that yeah. will come up. And it's one of those images that once you see it, you can't unsee it.
That's correct. I mean, I attached it to the show page and yeah. I had seconds. I said, ooh, I wonder if this is a little too crude and violent to put on my show page. But it is a piece of history as well as a piece of art.
Right. So what it shows, what it depicts is, the society in absolute depths of gin-addled depravity. But the central figure is a woman. I mean, she's barely recognizable as a woman, but she is a woman sat on the steps of St. Giles in a disgraced state. Her clothes are torn apart. She's covered in venereal sores. And she appears to be abandoning her baby over the side of the bridge. And it's widely assumed that this is meant to be a depiction of Judith Defour as the poster child. But what it's showing is the breakdown of society and the woman and specifically the mother at the heart of that. And it's important to remember that Gin Lane was produced with a companion piece, which was Beer Street. And Beer Street is meant to show what society looks like when people are drinking beer instead of gin. And it's important to remember that beer was a product that was consumed in alehouses that were places where women were not allowed. So it was this argument for this return to a more ordered society where women were in their place, everything was rosy.
Right. Well, I want to talk more on this, on the impact that these images and all of us has had on the perception of women in gin. But we have to take a quick break. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Sparks, host of the new podcast, The One Recipe, from the team behind The Splendid Table. This pod is all about that one recipe that you lean on. The one you share with friends, the one you make when you need a little love, and the one you know will work every single time. Every week, I talk with chefs and gifted cooks from all over the world about their one and the story behind it. We're here to help you build your kitchen library one dish at a time. Follow The One Recipe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Nicola Nice about gin, and actually gin and alcohol, and the perception of alcohol consumption by women from 300 years ago, and how it really hasn't really changed a whole lot, and why it has continued. There are some pretty crude names attached to some of the so-called women, famous women who... women's names attached to drunkenness that was also used in part of the propaganda. I think you pointed some of those out in your materials. Mm-hmm. Sarah Pisspot, Dorothy Addlebrains, or Sarah Suckwell. I mean, I can't believe this is 300 years ago and they're having these... Right. These really libelous names being attached to women. How in the world did this continue? As you say, that the narrative on women and alcohol, this propaganda really was ingrained in society.
Right. As we were saying before the break, there's not really any evidence to suggest that anywhere that women were drinking gin in higher numbers than men. And yet women were the ones who were kind of demonized for it as part of the propaganda on the part of the patriarchal government to bring this back under control. And, that was 300 years ago. And as you say, not much has really changed as we continue even today to talk about women's relationship with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when we talk about alcohol dependence and alcoholism, it is a very sensitive subject, and it's something that is a problem regardless of who has the issue, and it's a problem regardless of gender, and for many reasons, including the impact that it has on the people who are around the person who is affected. But it's interesting, even in the media today, to see how whenever statistics around, drinking rates and rates of alcoholism are quoted, the focus is always on the impact on women, even though in reality, there hasn't been any time in history where women have, consumed more or been more affected by any epidemic, including this one. However, you continue to see those narratives play out that somehow it's worse when it affects women. And again, it comes back to, I think, always the fact that women are mothers. I think even when you look at the access to treatment for alcoholism, for the longest time, it was really only communicated to women in regards to pregnancy, for example. So we still have warnings, right, about drinking when you're pregnant, as if that is the only the only time at which this is a problem, right, for women. But the truth is, even today, men consume three times more alcohol than women do. Alcoholism is the rate of alcoholism among men is twice as high as it is among women. And it's like I said, there's no amount of alcoholism that is okay. But to talk about this as if it is a problem for women when it's a universal problem is just something that when you look at the way the media talks about the gendered relationship with alcohol, just continues, even in a subtle way, to play out even today.
Well, and it's interesting because the famous, you know, temperance movement was largely run by women. Mm-hmm. So it's quite the opposite, you know, because women were the ones leading the fight to, you know, to limit drinking or make it, you know, illegal. Interesting. So what made you? When did we see things start to, let's say, calm down a bit?
Well, you mean in terms of gin consumption?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
sit around a beach scene in a movie or whatever around someone, the pool, and it's always, you know, the backyard. It's always, you know, summertime gin and tonic time.
Right.
And, you know, and that's that became very popular.
Yeah. So, I mean, gin has been through several phases of popularity, right? So, you know, if we talk about the evolution of Mother's Gin, as I like to say, from Queen Gin to Mother's Ruin and back up again, you know, I think actually the Queen was even, was it just last year, was told she had to give up her nightly gin martini. And there was a lot of outrage, you know, not the martini. but yes, so after, you know, fast forward and, you know, to the turn of the 19th century, the Regency era going on into the Victorian era, gin regained popularity, but what had changed at this time was a huge leap forward in production methods, meaning that the gin that was being produced was of vastly better quality than the gin of 100 years prior.
Oh, I would imagine. Hopefully.
And under the Victorians, gin started to regain popularity again, and it was less associated with the poor and the destitute, and again started to take, let's say, a classier turn in terms of who was consuming it. And also it was a lot lower proof, initially by law, but then also by tastes. So during the gin craze, I mean, people would drink the gin that people were consuming was like 160 proof. and so, you know, 100 years later, the proof was maybe half that, and even lower. And as we've sort of talked about before, the tastes changed as well in terms of the profile of gin. Mm-hmm. And the Victorians in particular enjoyed sweetening their gin and making these cordial styles. And this is going back to the discussion that you and I had on the last time we spoke, was women continuing to, in the home, use spirit bases to create cordials and liqueurs and other things. And so gin, obviously being very widely available, was often the base for these cordial style drinks that were served particularly by women to other women. So women would, after dinner, when men were having their brandies, would retire to the ladies' parlor and drink cordials and drink gin cordials. And these are sweetened gins and often had other flavors added to them too. So gin started to come back into the social rituals of women at that time. And then, of course, by the time gin started to be exported in greater volumes across the Atlantic, it found itself at the heart of the emerging cocktail boom. Mm. And by the time Prohibition came around and the cocktail party emerged, gin was at the center of probably two out of three of the cocktails that women were making as hostesses in the home. So it certainly continued to be a spirit that was enjoyed by women. And a lot of these cocktail recipes, especially the ones that emerged during Prohibition, emerged directly as cocktails that women were enjoying. Something like the Bee's Knees is a classic example of that.
Right, right. Okay, well, this cues me into your company's new product that's about to launch, and you have decided, you made a gin liqueur, but now you've decided to produce, or you have produced, a gin.
That's right.
I want to know about that, but also what we have started to see more commonly are gins with a different flavor forward, mm-hmm. whether it be more of a cucumber flavor, not flavored, but the taste that comes across more of, the juniper berry is so prevalent, but then other times you get more of this, these different botanicals coming through. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the gin that you're coming out with.
Yes. So Pomp and Whimsy is launching our dry gin in time for Mother's Day, actually, this spring. And as we like to call it, it is the mother of all gins.
keeping up with the theme here.
Keeping up with the theme. So as we sort of talked about before, Pomp and Whimsy Gin Liqueur is a cordial style gin, and we created that as a tribute to these styles of gin that were popular 150 years ago. And we wanted to update that style. We wanted to bring it back. But of course, from a brand point of view, make our mission to be rewriting the story of women and gin, rewriting the story of women and the cocktail. And it seemed like a natural next step to make the mother, to make the base gin as well. We started to get increasing number of requests for the base gin, to try the gin that goes into making Pomp and Whimsy Gin Liqueur. And we decided to go one step beyond that and actually perfect that gin to stand alone as its own spirit. So I'm excited to bring that out for people to try.
And what is it called? Just gin?
It's called Pomp and Whimsy Gin.
Pomp and Whimsy Gin.
Pomp and Whimsy Organic Gin.
That's important.
It's a certified organic gin. The liqueur is also, as of this year, certified organic too. So we continue to really promote this idea of creating clean spirits, spirits that use whole, natural, real ingredients. I think organic is a big part of that. It's obviously a nod to a broader, sustainable vision of how we make things today.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to that coming on the market. And what about flavor? Can you say anything about, just has the gin flavor?
Yes. So much like the liqueur, it's funny because when people taste the liqueur and when we've had people taste the dry gin as well, the juniper element is there. But what we've tried to do is highlight juniper in its softer form. A juniper can actually be quite citrusy. Yes. And doesn't always need to be so bitter and piney. So that's what we're really trying to highlight and showcase. The Pomp and Whimsy gin is quite floral, as you might imagine. It's not floral in terms of like a big bouquet of sweet flowers, or perfumey. I would describe it more as kind of spring or wild flowers. It has some herbal elements, and there's a strong note of grapefruit in there too. It's very bright, it's very spring-like, it's very fresh. It does really well in any clean spirited cocktails like a martini. And it's also extremely complementary, of course, to the liqueur. So creating a cocktail with a splash of the liqueur to amp up the gin notes to your own taste is what we're sort of encouraging our consumers to do. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to have to get an image of some of those advertisements from, I'm thinking particularly the 50s, you know, where we'd see parties and many times, you know, groups of women, and you could tell they were always drinking a gin and tonic. I've got to erase Hogarth's picture out of my mind.
Right, exactly.
So you've got your work cut out for you there.
We have to retell that story. And actually, you know, that's a big part of what we'll be doing as a brand over the, you know, not just this year and the years to come is, you know, we have long conversations about what is an act of restoration? How can we restore the name of Mother Gin? And we think that the best way to do that is just to keep retelling the story, but reframing it as we do.
Right.
And as we each tell the story and pass that story on, that is an act of restoration in and of itself. And of course, if we raise a glass in a toast, then even better.
Well, here I'm raising my pretend glass, and here's a toast to gin and to yours, and hopefully to, you know, a wonderful experience with it. And I wish you all kinds of success with that. And it's a fascinating history; it truly is.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk more about it.
Well, I look forward in the market, and thank you for sharing all your information. And to my audience, thank you for listening once again. It's been A Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.